Okay, we're reading here on the top of Kuf Chaf Aleph by the Mishnah. Mishnah says, "Nafala ma'im ben sheish lehem sof, ben she'en lehem sof, into waters that have an end and don't have an end." The Gemara will ask the question as to what is the defining factor over here. We'll give it away now, which is that the ability to see the banks of the area in which the water is contained. If you can't see all four sides of the banks, which means that you have visibility as to someone leaving the water, then that's called ma'im she'en lehem sof. In that case, nafal d'mayim ben sheish lehem sof, ben sheish lehem sof, ishto asura. His wife is considered to be asura because we're not certain as to his death. Amar Rabbi Meir, ma'aseh b'echad shenafal d'bor agadol, somebody fell into a big cistern, v'ala l'achar shlosha yamim, and he came out after 3 days. Bringing this, Rabbi Meir, as evidence that a person can stay alive for a duration in these situations where you would otherwise thought he would have been dead. And you see here that this guy showed up after 3 days. The Gemara will discuss the exact nature of the case. But Rabbi Meir seemingly is the author of this position in the beginning of the Mishnah. The way Rashi terms it is, the Savar Rabbi Meir, Adam yechol lechayot v'leshahot b'mayim oyom oyomayim. Person can live and survive in the water for a day or two. What exactly Rabbi Meir's considerations are as to why, whether he can tread water like that, or meaning that he thinks underwater. There are some Rishonim we're going to see in the Gemara that talk about the ability to survive in certain caves or areas around the water to allow a person to stay somewhat submerged, even though seemingly they have drowned at that point in time. Am Rabbi Yossi Maseh Besuma She'arad Litvo B'Ma'ara. There was this blind individual who went to go to the mikveh inside of a cave. V'yarad moshko acharav. And then after he had gone into the water and seemingly not coming back out, the person that was with him also got pulled in. Seems that they were tied together in order to help the suma. He kept him tied and then he went in after him. V'sha'u k'desh teitze nafsham. They waited around the mikveh, the cave, until the impossibility of anybody surviving being underwater for that duration of time. And they married off their wives based on that, assuming that they were definitely dead. They had passed away by the fact that they didn't emerge from the water. And clearly the Me'ara is a place where you can see all the edges. You can see anywhere where someone could emerge, and they didn't emerge from the water. There was this incident in Asia. It's not clear where this is, whether it's in Asia Minor or it's someplace up near the Syrian border by Hamad Gedera. That somebody was put into the water. So I mean that they lowered him into the water using a rope, for whatever reasons, whether he was going to catch fish, dive for pearls, whatever he was doing. V'lo al tabi adam el raglo. They pull the rope back in, and all that comes back in is his leg. So his leg has been severed from his body for whatever reason, whatever accident happened. Amru chachamim, min harakovo l'malo, depending where the leg was severed. If the leg was severed above the knee, which means that the part that they pulled back has the knee on it, up to the ire of the thigh, tinasei, then his wife can marry because the person will not survive such an injury. On the other hand, minarakovo lamato, if the leg that they came back to them was severed below the knee, they don't have the knee now, they just have the bottom of the leg, then lo tinasei, she cannot marry because there is a plausibility of survivability here, which is that the person is injured, but it's not a fatal injury, and therefore he could have survived. Obviously, they're talking about a case where it's ma'im she'en lehem sof. And therefore, they don't have the ability to see where he emerged from the water if he was able to survive in that situation. So, Tanu Rabbanan, nafal mayim ben sheish lehem sof, ben she'en lehem sof, ishto asura, divrei Rabbi Meir. So we mentioned in the Mishnah, this is the position of Rabbi Meir. It's irrelevant whether the water is waters that you cannot see the banks of or whether you can see the banks. Nevertheless, the person is considered to be asura because they can survive. Chamirmim, mayim sheish lehem sof, ishto muteret. In an area where you can see all the possible egresses from the water, in that instance, then his wife is mutarek because you would have seen it. Had he emerged from the water, he would have seen him. Shein lehem sof, ishto asura. On the other hand, in a place where you cannot see all the egresses, then you cannot permit his wife because he might have emerged somewhere where you couldn't see. Heichi dami mayim sheish lehem sof. So what is this idea that there is water that has an end to it? If you're standing in your location, you can see all four banks of the water body. That is considered to be Mayim Shiyesh Lehem Sof. Mayim Shein Lehem Sof is obviously where you cannot see all four banks because then you can't say definitively that he did not emerge from the water. He might have emerged from the water in the location where you can't see on a shoreline that you have no access to. How Gavra? The Tava be'agmo de Samke, this individual who drowned in the marshes of Samke, Intzava Rav Shila l'debitu. Rav Shila married off his wife. Amale Rav l'Shmuel, ta nishmate. Let us go put him into Shamta. Let's excommunicate him for this Pesach Halacha. So Amale Shmuel says, let's be a little bit more careful about before we put him into Shamta. Nishlach le Beresha. Let us ask him what he thinks the Halacha is before we put him into Shamta for this Pesach Halacha that he allowed the wife to get married based on this. Shachule Maim Shein Lem Sof, Ishto Asura Umuteret. In a case where you cannot see all the banks of the water body, is his wife Muteret or is she Asura? Shalach lehu Ishto Asura. They said that his wife is definitely Asura in that case. Va'agma de Samke, this marsh area of Samke, Maim Sheish Lem Sof or Maim Shein Lem Sof. What is the status of this area that you gave the Psak about? Obviously they didn't ask him, they're asking him from the outside. Shalach lehu Maim Shein Lem Sof. Who? That is definitely an area that where you can't see all the banks or all the places to emerge from the water. So if you're mitzarif his two statements, one that Maim Shein Lem Sof is Asura, plus he's paskening that the Agma, the Samke, is also a Maim Shein Lem Sof, he should have ruled that this woman is Asura. Umar, my time of Avad Hochi. So why did you do this? Why did you pasken for this woman that she could get married? So he says, Mita Teina says, I made a mistake. Anasavre came into Kavu Bekaimu Kamayim Sheish Lem Sof. Since this is still water, this is a closed water body, I thought that it has the equivalence of Mayim Sheish Lem Sof, dummy. Velohi, and I'm wrong about that. Came into Ika Gali, because there are waves over there. Himor Gali Ashpalo, that the waves carried him to the shoreline. So the feeling or the consideration here in Mayim Sheish Lem Sof is that the currents, the strong currents of the water, or the waves of the water can carry an individual to distances that they otherwise wouldn't swim, or give them the ability to make it to the shoreline. Remember, in their day, most people did not know how to swim. It was unlikely they knew how to swim when they were out in the water. So now, if someone's boat capsizes in the water, and now they're left out there, the reason that Maim Shein Lem Sof, we assume that they might survive, is because they could be carried by the water, by the waves, by the wind, to a shoreline where we can't see it. When you're dealing with a body of water that is contained and doesn't have the natural currents of the ocean or the movements of the ocean or of a river that moves quickly, then the person would have to swim to the shoreline. That's the only way they could get there. They wouldn't be moved by the water itself. So his assumption is by this marsh of Samke that it would not naturally carry him to the shoreline. But in the end, he says, I was wrong about that, because even in a contained body of water like a lake, when you have an enclosed lake, like the Kinneret itself, when you have an enclosed body, the wind still causes waves in that. So even though you don't have tides and currents inside of the lake, you still have the wind that creates a certain amount of wave activity at the surface. And that means that you could be carried by those waves to the shoreline. And so he says, I made a mistake. Ishkari Shmuel later Rav. Shmuel says about Rav, Lo yi'une litzadik kol avin, that no bad will befall the tzadik. So over here, Rav was about to put Rav Shila into Shamto, into excommunication, and Hashem protected Rav from putting him into excommunication improperly, because Rav Shila himself backed out of his position and didn't intentionally try to paskin against the Halacha. He had thought, logically, that there was a reason to differentiate over here. And in the end, he realized that that was not correct. It was not the proper way to differentiate. Karel Rav Alei de Shmuel. Rav says about Shmuel, Uchua Berov Yoetz. Salvation comes from taking a lot of advice. And here Shmuel advised him about what to do here, and therefore he didn't excommunicate the individual. Now, in terms of halacha that comes out of this, there's two things that are interesting. One is, it's brought in the Otzar Poskim, that Uchua Berov Yoetz, that when in cases of Agunot, that a person should not paskin alone. That they should gather together, first of all, a Beit Din, in order to do it together, even if they do a lot of the research or a lot of the effort, they should still get a Beit Din to bring with them. And then on top of that, they should consult with the Gedolim of the Gedolei Ador. And that's not enough simply to make a decision here, but you have to be Tshuva Berov Yoetz, that taking counsel in these matters is very important. And therefore, in any situation like this, generally the Gedolim speak with other Gedolim about it, because they want to make sure that they're not making a mistake over here. Number two is, once we paskin for an Aguna, that she is Muteret, we generally do not open the case again. The person who gives the Psak Halacha shouldn't go back and review the case over and over again. Again, unless there's a mistake that's going to cause. Over here, there is circumstantial evidence that he didn't show up. Besides that, he paskined incorrectly. We won't reverse the psak here if she's already married. If she didn't marry yet, then they might have reversed the psak because he made a mistake. But had she married, they wouldn't have reversed the psak, assuming that there's other circumstantial evidence that he probably is dead. We're just worried, or we're choshesh for that miut where he didn't made it out. And here, because the psak was given already, we won't reverse it. That's also an important consideration whenever people are matir agunot, is that the rabbanim, once they give the psak, should not go back to it. And they should not have other halakhic authorities look at it once it's given, because otherwise that will leave the aguna in limbo forever. Because it'll always be that she has to look for other people to give a psak halacha or to approve of the psak halacha, and we don't want that. We want the psak halacha to be matir the aguna to move on in her life and be able to marry. All right, next. Tanya. Amar Rabbi. Maseh b'shnei bnei adam machmarim machmichmurim b'yardein. There were these two individuals who were out there. They seemed to be fishermen who had nets in the Yardain. They were out there fishing or gathering fish with the nets. B'chnas echad mehen l'mechila shel dagim. And one of them went into a tunnel of sorts, a cave, a tunnel that you sometimes find, many times you find them in the rivers that gouge out of the rock. You have the channels of the rivers. On the sides, there are caves or inlets in which the water fills, and there are fish in there in those inlets. Now, those inlets, you can go in there, and even though you are technically even sometimes below the water line, once you get into the cave, there's airspace above, and a person's able to breathe and survive over there by keeping their head above the water line. So now, v'shakachama, so this one fisherman went in there, and the sun set. And he couldn't find his way out of this cave or this tunnel where the fish were. His friend, the other fisherman outside, waited, and he says, the guy definitely drowned. Nobody can survive underwater for this long. So he came back and he told the family that the fisherman had passed away. His friend, the fisherman, was underwater. He never came back out. He never surfaced. He must have died. The machar zachar chama. The next morning, the sun rises. The fisherman who had been submerged in the tunnel then finds his way out of the tunnel because now it's light out. When it's dark out, remember, no flashlights, no ways to get out. If you have a flashlight, maybe you could see. But if you don't have a flashlight, there's no way when it's pitch black out to see where the exit from the tunnel was. So he was unable to get out. When the sun rose, he had the light and he was able then to emerge from the tunnel. Uba umatzeh hefeid gadol betoch beito. Comes home to find his own eulogy going on in his house. Amar Rabbi, kama gdolim divrei chachamim. How amazing are the words of the chachamim? Shemru ma'im sheish lem sof ishto muteret. Waters where you can see the banks, ishto muteret. She'en lem sof ishto asura. In the case where they have no ends, you can't see the banks of the water body, then his wife remains asura. So over here too, you say that ishto asura because they couldn't see. Now, the cases here are not equivalent. And it's not so straightforward that Rabbi is saying what he's saying in the face of the Mechila. The case here is very particular, and it has nothing to do with the ability to see the banks. The fisherman here could have seen all the banks of the river. It could have been Mayim Sheizlam Sof. That wasn't the issue. The issue was the Mechila and the ability to survive inside of the Mechila. Mar says, so Ihochi, if this is true, Mayim Sheizlam Sof Nami Lechosh the Mechila Shel Dagim. The Gemara basically takes that up and says, listen, according to what Rabbi is saying over here, that this is considered also to be Mayim Sheein Lem Sof, that means that even in cases where you can see all the banks of the water body, we should be afraid that maybe the guy got into a tunnel and survived in the tunnel or survived in this air pocket that was there. So Mar says, if that's the case, when you have Mayim Sheish Lem Sof, then you should also worry about the fact that he survived. Mar says, Mayim Sheish Lem Sof, Mechila Shel Dagim Lo Shechicha. These types of tunnels or these types of air pockets are not common in places where the water body is in a small area or in a, you have the ability to see all the banks. In those areas, you generally don't find these types of tunnels. So even though technically you're right, there is this chashash that you could have survived in such a situation, these situations don't come up, basically. It's a very, very far-fetched case. And the Chachamim are not going to be gozer in that case that his wife shouldn't get married because of that risk that there was a tunnel that he had his head above the water in. So in the end, that's how he survived. He was able to keep his head above the water in the tunnel, and then he emerged the next day. Amar Vashi, Had amru rabbanan, mayim shein lem sof ishto asura, hainim mile bi'inish da'alma. Ravashi has a very interesting logic here. Similarly to me, it makes a lot of sense. The Gemara rejects it here and rejects it later on in this sugya as well. which is that what we fear here is that the person emerges somewhere else where we can't see them. And when they emerge over there, then they go basically decide to have a new life. They say, that's it. You know, I had enough with everything else. I'm going to start a whole new life. And they don't get in contact with us. And even though they're alive, they don't send back word that they really are alive. Now, in the day where communications were limited and distances were hard, it's a very high possibility or high likelihood that something like that could happen. Even if a person wanted to be in communication, he might emerge in a place where he can't get back to the original location. People don't travel there. They're at war. Whatever reasons, they can't get back. Today, with the modern day communication, it's unlikely that a person will emerge in a place that he can't get back. Now, again, there are today still countries that are unfriendly where you can end up and you may be in a situation where you cannot contact or get in touch back home. But the basic concept here is that the person we assume would get in touch with us. And if that's the case, then what Rav Ashi says is, Hadam ru ma'abana ma'im shen lam sof, ishto asru anamila b'inish da'alma. That's what normal people. Aval tzurma mi rabbonon lo. When you have a young Talmud Chacham, someone who has a little more famous, recognizable, people would know who they were, then that case not. Because Ida Salik, if he emerges, or Ida the Salik, Kale Itle, if he emerges somewhere else, then it would be known. People will know who he is. That's if somebody who is a famous individual emerges somewhere and says, I want to hide from everybody, I want to start a new life, they're not capable of doing that because people will recognize them in the new place. You have to have a certain amount of anonymity to start over in a new place where nobody knows who you are and you're not famous at all. And a person who has well-known or their face is well-known or their name is well-known and people know about them, then it's very hard to hide or keep your anonymity. So what Rav Ashi says is, if in cases that this is a famous individual, when they emerge in this new location, we'll get word that they're alive because there's a certainty that someone knows who they are and they'll send word back that we know about this individual. We can't keep that hidden. Velohi. And the Gemara rejects that and says, Loshna inish da'alma, Loshna tzumer demira banan. It makes no difference about a normal individual. It doesn't make any difference about a tzumer demira banan. In both cases, we're going to say that the woman is asura. Diavad in the chatchilolo. Gemara says here, and the Gemara will also conclude at the end of the sugya the same way, that by these cases where in all likelihood the individual died, but because it's Maim Shein Lam Sof, or because of whatever reasons we are choshesh that the person's alive, if the woman got married without consulting with us, diavad, we leave her married. We don't get involved, we don't interfere. The chatchila, she comes to ask us what the psak halacha is, we will not tell her that she can get married because we don't have evidence of the fact that her husband passed away. So Tanya, Amar Rabbi Gamliel, Pamachat Hayiti Malech Bisfina. Gamliel says that once I was going along in a boat, and I saw another boat that capsized while I was journeying. And I was distraught over the Talmud Chacham who was on that boat. One of the passengers on that boat was a famous Talmud Chacham, Umanu. Who was that passenger? Rabbi Akiva. So he thought he had lost Rabbi Akiva in the other boat that had capsized because his boat was fine, but the other boat capsized and he was worried. When I reached my destination and I was back on dry land, Bab Yashav V'dan Lefanai B'Alacha. Rabbi Akiva all of a sudden shows up and he's having a discourse in Alacha with me. He couldn't contain himself. Amarti lo bini mihi Alacha. Who brought you out of the water? How'd you get out of this? There's just no way that you could have survived. It was Maim Shein Lam Sof. There was no place for you to go. How did you survive here? Amarli Daf shel Sfina nizdamnein li. One of the boards of the boat came to me, meaning that I was able to hold on. A piece of the boat was there, and I was able to hold on to that piece of the boat to stay afloat. Chol gal v'gal shibalai, and every wave that came on top of me, neneti lo roshi. I bent my head down. Basically, I ducked, and the wave went over me, and I was able to come out the other side of the wave. Mikan amru chachamim, im yavo rishayim al adam. If bad people come, evil people come to attack an individual or to cause problems for an individual, yinaneolo rosho, person should bow their head, be acquiescing, be submissive in this case. Amarti, botosha kamagdolim divrei chachamim. Rabbi Gamliel says the same thing that Rabbi said, which is, wow, how wonderful are the words of the chachamim. Shamru maim sheish lem sof muteret. In a case where you can see all the banks, then the wife is muteret. Maim Shein Lam Sof Asura, because here Rabbi Akiva emerged from the water in a situation Rabbi Gamliel thought he was definitely drowned and that he had not survived. Rabbi Gamliel is shocked when Rabbi Akiva shows up at the Beit Din or wherever Rabbi Gamliel was to talk to him. He goes, how did he survive? And Rabbi Akiva describes how he survived. Now, there are two important things that come out of this. The first one is about the Minanei Rosho. Is that person is submissive. This goes to Gemaras that we see in other places, as well as some of the Mishnayot and Avot, which is that every dog has his day, that there are certain times when the Rishaim are ascendant, and Asha'ah Mesachekik Lo is the terminology that the Gemara says, which is that things are going well for the Rasha. And then the Gemara says, when things are going well for the Rasha, don't attack him at that point. Don't try to take him on. Don't try to win. Because basically, the mazel is on his side. Things are going well for him. If you try to undermine him at that point, you're actually going to lose. Even though you're the better person, even though Hashem should be on your side, nevertheless, you don't attack. So in that case, this is what the Gemara is saying, something in a similar vein, which is that when you come up against the Rasha who's succeeding, and he's almost in a sense attacking you, don't try to take him on at that point in time, because things are going well for him. What you do is you bow your head. You wait for your time. You have to wait for your chance, for your time when things start to fall. It's also found in the Megillah. Megillat Esther, when Haman comes back home and he tells his family about what had happened, then his family says to him, or his advisors say back to him, well, if you've begun to fall before the Yehudim, then you're going down. This idea that once you crested and you come over the top and things start to unwind, once they begin to unwind, then you can pile on. And that's what the Gemara says here. While the things are going well for the Rishaim, don't get involved. When things are going downhill, that's your chance, that's your moment to speak up or to break away or to dismiss, get rid of this Rasha. That's number one. Number two is, as Josh mentioned in the, before the Shir, this Gemara is famously quoted by Mamer Shapiro in his establishment when he wanted to start the Daf. He quoted this Gemara, and he says about this story about Rabbi Akiva, that Imalei Hadaf, had it not been for that board, he wouldn't have survived. And allegorically, Rabbi Shapiro said that about the Daf Hayomi. Yimalei Hadaf. If it wasn't for the Daf Hayomi, I wouldn't have survived. This idea of Kviut Itim LeTorah, that a person should learn and have a structure by which they are learning at the same pace as everybody in the world. So this idea of the Daf that is mentioned here in the Gemara is one that Rabbi Meir Shapiro raised as allegorically one of the reasons to do the daf, because the daf would ensure the survival of learning and the people's ability to engage in Gemara, just like it did for Rabbi Akiva. All right, Tanya, I'm Rabbi Akiva, Pam Achad Hayiti Melech B'Sfina. So a similar story, but here Rabbi Akiva, instead of being the one on the boat that capsizes, and the one on the boat that is doing okay, which is Hayiti Melech B'Sfina, Hayiti Sfina Achad Shenit Mitarefet Bayam. I saw a boat that was being tossed around, was having difficulty in the ocean, out in the sea. And I was worried about the Talmid Chacham that was there, Umanu Rabbi Meir, one of the Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Meir was on that boat. So when I docked in Kaputkia, which seems to be somewhere in northern Africa, where Rabbi Akiva visited, the Gemara in Perek HaChelek talks about it there as well, about this area called Kaputkia. Similarly to what had happened with Rabbi Kiva, Rabbi Gamliel, all of a sudden Rabbi Meir shows up and he's having a halachic discourse with him. Marti lo bini, mi alcha, who took you out of the water? How'd you get out? Amarli gal, tirdeni lechaveiro, 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 achikiani leyabasha. He basically, I rode the waves. I was a great surfer. Basically, one wave picked me up, passed me to the next wave, and passed me to the next wave. And basically, the waves carry him to the shoreline, and he was able to survive that way. The water went in his direction, and he was able to be pushed in a direction that took him to the shoreline. That goes back to Rav Shila's comment before, where he said he was in a closed body of water, he thought that there wouldn't be this issue. But then he says the wind causes waves. Over here you see the story of Rabbi Meir, that the waves helped to carry him to the shoreline. Rabbi Kiva has the same refrain as Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi, which is, how great are the words of the Chachamim, Shamru Maim Sheish Lem Sof Ishto Muteret, in a place where you can see the shoreline, his wife is Muteret, Maim Sheish Lem Sof Ishto Asura, because here Rabbi Meir shows up after Rabbi Akiva thought that he had drowned at sea. Right, Tarabanan. Now the Gemara is going to go through different examples of fatalities or incidents where we think a person should definitely be dead. And the question is, can you, based on the evidence, think that they're dead? So the first one is Nafalu Gova Rayot. He's thrown into a lion's den. Like Daniel was thrown into the lion's pit. Is there a situation where a person survives when they're thrown into a lion's den? So, ain meidin alav. You cannot testify about that because there's a chance that the person might survive. Because sometimes, as Rashi said, lions are just not hungry. If they're not hungry, they don't eat. Lions eat when they're hungry. When they're not hungry, they don't eat. So there's a possibility of a person surviving when they are thrown into a lion's den. B'chafura mele'an nechashim v'akrabim. On the other hand, if they're thrown into a snake pit, a scorpion pit, me'idin alav, then you can be certain that he did not survive. Rabbi Yehuda ben Beteira omer, af lechafura mele'an nechashim v'akrabim, ein me'idin alav. Even into a snake or scorpion pit, you cannot testify that he is automatically dead. Chashina and shema chaverhu. We worry about the fact that he might be a chaver. Chaver comes from what the Torah says, chover chaver. That is, that he's a charmer. That he has the ability to charm the snakes and the scorpions and keep them at bay. The Tanakama. Why doesn't the Tanakama worry about the fact that this person might have those capabilities? Because a gav itzitza maskile. Because in a snake pit or in a scorpion pit, if he's thrown in there or falls in there, there's no way that he doesn't land on one of them. And when you land on one of them, they get pretty upset. And when they're upset, they don't worry about being charmed. They bite and they sting no matter what. So he says, because of that issue, versus the lions, where there's a possibility you don't land on the lions don't cover the whole area, and they may not be hungry. Here, by the snakes and scorpions that are all over the place, if he steps on one or lands on one of them, then for sure he was stung or bitten by them, because they will not, no matter what you do, no matter how much you try to charm them, they will not be subdued at that point in time. You can't testify about him that he definitely died from this situation. Tarim banan. Nafalatof kivshana ish. If he falls into a furnace, meidim alav. Over there, you can testify about him because there is a limited scope or space within the furnace. And if we don't see him emerge from the furnace, then he definitely died from the heat of the furnace or being inside the furnace. Again, this assumes that it's a limited size of furnace and there are no places to escape to. Lo yoreh mleya yayin v'shemen. If he's in a cauldron, he falls into a cauldron full of wine or oil. Meidim alav. You can testify about him that he definitely died in this cauldron. It's on the fire, boiling oil or boiling wine, and he falls in there. He certainly could not get out, as Rashi talks about here, because his feet will touch the bottom of the cauldron, which is so hot, and that will injure him in a way that he won't be able to swim back or resurface once he falls in there. So because of that, we can testify that he for sure will not emerge from this. By oil, because that accelerates the fire, then you can testify about him. But by wine, because it doesn't accelerate, but rather extinguishes. What seemingly is being described here by Rav Acha is that you have a cauldron full of wine or shemen. When the person is dropped into there, or falls into there, he displaces some of the wine or some of the shemen, and it goes over the side of the cauldron. But when it goes over the side of the cauldron, then it drips down or goes down into the fire. The fire that's below, how does it impact the fire below? So when you displace oil from the cauldron and it goes into the fire below, that's an accelerant. So it's going to cause the fire to get hotter and it's going to actually make a situation worse inside. On the other hand, if he's in wine, the cauldron of wine, and he displaces the wine and goes over it, the wine will actually extinguish the fire down below. It is a retardant, and therefore it'll cause the fire to be extinguished. If that's the case, it might allow him to survive because the heat then will not increase, but rather will start to diminish in this case. Amar lo, they said back to Rav Acha, tchilato michabeh, sofo mavir. That's not the true, because it's true by water as well. It's not just true by wine, but certain retardants, for instance, as Rashi gives an example, if you throw water on a fire, you have a big bonfire and you throw water on it, then what happens is it subdues the fire for a short period of time. And then the fire comes back even stronger afterwards. As soon as it burns off the liquid, it comes back. So the same thing here with the wine. Obviously, again, it would matter how big the fire is and how much wine was displaced. But at first, it causes the fire to be subdued. But then afterwards, it comes back even stronger, and it'll be heat up again, and he won't be able to survive. All right, Avraham Meir. Maseh b'echad shenafal b'bor agadol. There was this incident where this guy fell into this large cistern. In general, a boar. In the Gemara, a bor is a cistern, but it's also a location that has water in it. By definition, there's water in there, so he fell into the bor gadol, he's submerged in the water. Question is, how does he survive submerged in the water? So Tanya Amar Lo Rabbi Meir, Ein maskirin maseh nisim. You can't bring an example from a miraculous survival. This person survived, it was miraculous that they survived. You can't bring proof to that now we have to worry about every person that falls into a large cistern that they're going to survive. My maseh nisim. What's the miraculous feature here that this person survived? What, that he didn't eat or drink for 3 days? That's not a miraculous vaktiv. Esther says to Mordechai, tell the people, and she says for 3 days, don't eat, don't drink for 3 days. So Esther's telling the people to fast for 3 days means that people can survive not eating and not drinking for 3 days. That's it. Ella, delo naim. He didn't sleep. There's no way that he could survive in the water without sleeping for 3 days. Da'ama Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan says a person who takes shua shlo ishan, shlosha yamim, person who takes a shua that he will not sleep for 3 days, then what do you do? Malkinoto. We give him malkot for a shuat shav, vishan the altar. And then he can sleep right away. There's no way he can keep this shua. So it is a shuat shav. Therefore, you give him malkot for taking such a shua, and you let him sleep right away because he's not going to be able to keep the shua. Means it's impossible to go without sleep for 3 days straight. The Gemara in Sukkah asks about the Simchat Beit HaShoeva, where they describe their itinerary during the Simchat Beit HaShoeva, which did not include sleep. And the Gemara there asks the same question. How is it they didn't sleep for 3 days straight? The Gemara says there that they rested on each other's shoulders and they dozed off. They took these cat naps while they were there. But nobody can survive. Why is that an issue here? Because he's in a cistern. He's in a water body. He's down in the water. If he falls asleep, he dies. He needs a place where he can fall asleep without slipping or without being into the water. Now, if he's holding on to something that's keeping him above the water level, if he falls asleep, he's going to be submerged into the water. If he's treading water, he falls asleep, he's going to be submerged in the water. If it was 3 days before he emerges from this large cistern, that means that he had to go 3 days without sleep in order to survive inside of the cistern. Remember, in general, the way that cisterns are made, they're made to be waterproof. So if you go in today, you can see them. You're going to go up a Masada, you go in all these places that you visit. They dig out a cave, they dig out into the bedrock, and then they put lime around it in order to make it waterproof. So there are no locations to hold on to, there's no place to rest, because the places are built to be waterproof, and they are slippery, and there's no location to hold on to. Rabbi Meir, my time on. So what's the reasoning of Rabbi Meir, who says that this isn't a miracle that he survived, that he was able to survive through normal efforts? I'm Rav Kana, kipin agavi kipin habu. This bore, this cistern was built through a double arch, or a double kippah, which is that they built it by creating two different structures. There was a lower structure and an upper structure, which is actually what's mentioned by certain places like Marat HaMachpelah, and even maybe Kever Rachel, as one of the things that might protect the Kohanim. Some of the tshuvot that you find talk about the fact that they might be able to enter because it's a kippah gabe kippah, which means that there's two levels, and there's an oel on top of an oel, which might protect it for Kohanim to be able to enter there because the Tumat HaMeit does not rise. But the idea of Kipin HaGabi Kipin was a way to build, which is that if you had to gain height in their day, you built an arch, and then you built another arch above the original arch. It's the second level of arches. So that's how they got height. You build the arch, another arch, and then in the opposite direction, you build another set of arches that go on top of it. So there was a Kipin HaGabi Kipin that it can hold on to. Rabbanan de Shishavu. That doesn't help because they were made out of marble. And guess what? Marble's slippery. You can't hold on to marble. There's no way that you can find a grip on marble or you could rest on marble because you're going to slide right off the marble. Rabbi Meir, Yevshara de lo masrich v'naim purta. There's no way that he couldn't just hang on for a little bit onto this marble and fall asleep for a short time, doze off for a short time. That means even though it's slippery, he could have somehow rested himself or leaned himself against it for some point in time that allows him to rest or take a nap during that period of time. Tanrabanan, famous story we had in the Gemara Baba Kama. It's also found in the Mishnayot and Shkalim. Maseh bebitosh Nechunya chofer shichin. There was a case by the daughter of Nechunya who used to dig out borot. He used to dig out cisterns. And part of his avoda that he did as pro bono work is that he used to dig out cisterns for the Olei Regalim. So he used to dig out these large cisterns that would fill during the winter season. And the Olei Regalim, when they came up, they were able to utilize these water channels or these water pits that he put together. So Nafla de Bora Gadol, his daughter fell into a large cistern. Uvavo dio de Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa. And they came and told Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa about it. Shari shona amar dehem shalom. After the first hour he said she's still fine. Shnia amar dehem shalom. After the second hour he said she's fine. Shlishit amar dehem alta. After the third hour he says she's out of the pit. Amar la biti melacha. So then when she came back, and she actually came out, they asked her, who took you out? How'd you get out of the Bora Gadol? Amar lo, Zachar shel rechalim nizdamen li. A male, you, showed up. Basically an ayo. This would be the ayo of Akedat Yitzchak. V'zaken manhigo. And an elderly man was leading the ayo. So Rashi says over here that it was Avram Avinu. On the other hand, others say that it was Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa. That was someone that looked like Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa. Amrulo, so they turned to Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa, Naviata. Are you a Navi? You're able to know that she was coming up in the third Adar? How did you know this? He's saying, no, she's fine, and now she's out. How did he know that this person came and saved her? Amar lehem, lo Navi anochi, lo ben Navi anochi. I'm not a Navi, I'm not a prophet, I'm not the son of a prophet. Ella, davar shetzadik mitasek bo yikashel bo zaro? How could it be that something that the person dedicates his life to doing good in digging out borot and making the water available for the Yolei Regalim, for their yikashel bo zaro, that his offspring should die in such a manner? It'd be inconceivable that a midah keneged midah, that this person did all this good and his daughter would die in something that is something that he does for good for other people. And therefore he believed in the first hour, in the second hour, where she could survive in the boar, he said she was fine. By the third hour, where she wouldn't have survived if she had stayed in there, then he assumed that she came out. He assumed she came out because Hashem would protect the tzaddik. So Rabbi Abba, so here's a sad end to the story. Afu pi kein, made beno b'tzama. That even though Nechunya chofer shichin, his daughter was survived, or was saved when she fell into the cistern, nevertheless his own son died of thirst. That he dehydrated and didn't have liquid. Again, how could it be? Here is someone who provided water for the Yolei Regalim, someone who took care of other people's needs for drinking, and his own son dies b'tzameh. Shenemar, and here the Gemara says, v'svivav nis'ara me'od, that around him is very stormy. But over here, the Gemara is darshaning it, melameid shekodesh baruch hu medakdek im svivav kechut ha'sara. Hashem is very particular with those that surround him, kechut ha'sara, like the fineness of a hairbreadth. That means that Hashem, with his own tzaddikim, does not give even an inch. And if they do something wrong, Hashem takes retribution on it. Now, retribution, both in the sense of stronger, or maybe more, even more powerful than they would have expected for the small infraction that they violated, but also in the sense that it's not quid pro quo for what they did, given who they are. But nevertheless, Hashem takes it out on them. The other one is, Rabbi Chanina Amar Mihalcha, that we learn out of here, Kel Naratz. That Hashem is elevated, is exalted, b'sod kiddushim rabah, with the secrets of His holy ones, and His awesomeness comes on those that are around Him. Again, suggesting that those that are around, those that are close to Him, are mekadeshim shemayim by their death. So here the Gemara talks about this idea, and it can come from a number of planes over here when you're discussing this issue with tzaddikim. Which is that when a tzaddik does something wrong, not only is there a small infraction that takes place, there's also a tremendous chilul Hashem that takes place, because people look up to the tzaddik, people look up to these individuals, and when they have a small infraction, it's actually the waves that are set in motion because that are magnified because of their greatness. That means that basically the higher you are, the harder you're going to fall. And even though, again, the infraction is so small, nevertheless, Hashem has to take strong retribution in order to offset that negativity that was created by such a small infraction. On the other hand, there is also a view here in the Rishonim that sometimes these punishments are not necessarily Yisurim that are connected some sort of infraction, but rather these are Yisurim Shalava, but they're also a lesson for other people. If the Tzadikim or the Chasidim, Hashem, punishes them in this way, woe to the Rishonim, woe to other people. If this is what happens to people who are of great stature, then we gotta worry about what's happening to us. That's another aspect here. The third aspect is this idea that Hashem sometimes takes retribution in this world on the tzaddikim in order to preserve their olam haba. That for this moment, if He gives the punishment now, then He can preserve, He can give them a greater chilek, the olam haba, and then, therefore there's a value in doing that. Now here, it's interesting because you have two psukim that are brought. One says, Vivab nis'ara me'od, that it goes around, he is like, checks them like the hairbreadth. And the other one is v'noral kol svivav, that Hashem is awesome on all svivav. Is there a difference in the sense of the two psukim that we bring? One pasuk seems to suggest the same thing as the other pasuk, but you can see from the way that the Gemara reads it is that when it comes to svivav nisara mode, is that Hashem is medavdek misvivav kachut ha'sara, means with cause. It seems to be that there is cause for the reason that Hashem is punishing. The second pasuk that is brought does not talk about a cause and effect. It simply says that Hashem takes out retribution on the tzaddikim. And that might relate to the two different explanations that we gave, that one of them is talking about retribution, which is where they violated, they had an infraction. Over there, Hashem takes out on them. On the other side, we have Venora Kol Sviviv, is that sometimes even when it has nothing to do with what they're deserving of, or whether they should be punished, Hashem still takes out His anger on them, whether because the generation is not worthy, or because these individuals set an example for, like Rashi says in Chumash and other places, that the death of these individuals, like Nadav and Avihu, teach a lesson to everyone else about how they should act or how they should behave. Now, Rav Shmulevitz, Rav Chaim Shmulevitz in Sichut Musar, quotes this idea, Svivav Nisara Me'ov, he brings it in a number of places on something called Shleimut HaMaaseh, that he says that we have to have no personal nitiyot, or no personal investments in when we do mitzvot and when we worship Hashem. When we worship Hashem, it really has to be Shalom and not the Kabel Pras. Not to get rewards, not for personal benefit or not for personal kavod. We do it because it's the right thing to do. And he says that Hashem is medakdek al the tzaddikim when they have ulterior motives. For whatever reason, they get some personal benefit or ulterior motive over here, then that causes Hashem to punish them because He wants to purify the act. And the act should be solely towards Hashem and not for any personal gain. And that's how he explains this idea of Svivav Nisara Me'od, and again, separating between, on the one side, that Hashem will never punish the individual with something, Shikasha Bozaro, that his descendants will not be hurt by something that he does a mitzvah in. But on the other side, here, we do see that his son died of thirst. So now you could argue in two ways. One is, it's not exactly alike. In the case where his daughter fell into the cistern, she was saved because that's exactly what he did. He dug cisterns, so that's where she was saved. Over here, when his son dies of thirst, yes, he dug cisterns that had the implications of water filling in them and people didn't get to drink. But that wasn't his direct action. His direct action was digging up cisterns, and that's why his son was not protected from thirst. Or you could argue, and this is what Chaim Shalevin says, is that maybe he took some kavod from that it wasn't just a purely altruistic type of act. And because of that, Hashem punished him for that fact that he didn't do it only altruistically. He took some benefit. He took some kavod from what he did. And because of that, Hashem is Nisara Me'od, that Hashem takes his medakdekim et tzadikim kechut asara, if they take some personal benefit or have some ulterior motive to what they do, besides the true worship of Hashem. Now the next Mishnah continues, and then maybe we'll talk a little bit about issues in the modern day and in the World Trade Center. Even if they hear women talking and saying that a person passed away, that's enough. Omrim, if he hears the young children saying, that we're going to bury and eulogize so-and-so. Benchu mitkavein, benishrein mitkavein. Doesn't matter whether they're intending to testify or not testify. It's just a question of we get the information over here again by these types of edut. We're not looking for edut testimony. We're looking for information. And that's what we want. We mean varir milta. And as long as we can rely on these individuals to be telling the truth, then we're going to rely on the information that they provide to us. Rav Yehuda ben Bava Omer, Bisrael, afal pi shehu mitkavein. By Israel, it doesn't matter if he's coming to testify or he's just speaking lefi tumo. He's just speaking to his friends, saying some information over. Ve'ed kochavim haya mitkavein en edutu edut. By the way, ve'ed kochavim, if he intends to come and testify, he's not a kosher aid. So he can't be a person that gives testimony. On the other hand, if he simply gives us information or facts, then he can be believed because of the facts that he is providing. Otherwise, we assume that he might be exaggerating or he might be pounding his chest, and therefore we can't believe him in terms of edut. We can only believe him if he's just talking about information where there's no personal possibility of gain or reason that he would do this. We'll see that in tomorrow's Gemara as well, that sometimes they lie in order to aggrandize their position or what they did, and therefore they lie about what they did. Gemara says, V'duma lo azlit. So wait a minute, maybe they didn't go. Here in the Mishnah it says that they were talking about the fact that they're going to a hesped, they're going to a kvura. How do you know that they actually went to the kvura? It's one thing to testify that, okay, they were going there, but that doesn't mean he was dead. Maybe the guy never showed up. Maybe the body never came. Some of you, the Mashmuel, the Kamrei, Harenu, Ba'im, Milispod, Ulamikbor, Etich Ploni. It's not that we're going to, but we came back from the funeral. We just came back from the eulogy. So over there, they're talking in the past tense, not in the future tense. The Dilma, Kamsa, Ba'alma, Shachivle. Maybe it was just a grasshopper that passed away. Vasigulei al Shmei, and that was their pet grasshopper. They called him by that name of this guy. Now, if you remember the Gemara in Shabbat, the Mishnah in Shabbat talk about the ability of children to play with grasshoppers, and whether you're allowed to let them play with a grasshopper that's not kosher, because we're afraid if his grasshopper dies that he might eat the grasshopper. So they only give him kosher grasshoppers to play with, or even non-kosher grasshoppers. So there the Gemara has a machloket about this issue. And question, wait, if it was his pet grasshopper, he'll never eat his pet grasshopper because he's too friendly, it means too much to him. But over here, the Gemara suggests a similar idea, that this toy grasshopper might have a name. And the toy grasshopper he's talking about is got the same name as this guy. And how can you be sure that they talked about a human being rather than they're talking about their pet grasshopper? So the Gemara says, the kamre chen v'chein rabbanon avatam, so-and-so, this great rabbi was there, v'chein v'chein sabdane avatam, and this and this eulogizer were there. They give you facts that indicate that there was definitely a real funeral over here, and we're talking about a real person, not just about their little toy grasshopper. The only time we don't accept the edut, the testimony of a non-Jew, is if he's coming to specifically be matir this woman to marry. But if he comes to testify, we're okay. If he's going to give us information, it's fine. If he's coming specifically because he knows whatever he's going to say is going to be matir this woman and he wants to help the woman out, there we have a problem. How do we know? How do we know what his intent is over here? If he comes to Beit Din and says, listen, the husband passed away, you can marry off his wife. Then he's clearly being mitkaven to be matir. If he just comes along and tells us the information that he died, then he's just telling us information and that's fine. The only problem is when he's coming specifically to be matir the woman. If he's just coming to give us information, we have no problem with that. Isn't this the case where we had this incident with Oshaya Beribi? Beribi means the great one, or the great Rav. So this is Rabbi Oshaya that he's speaking about. Shehetiram im 85 zekinim, that he was matir in a case with 85 other zekinim. Amar lehem, lo shanu el shenitkaven latir. Aval gnitkaven haide duto, velo hodu lo chachamim. Even though he brought this testimony and said exactly what Rish Lakish said and exactly what Shmuel said, nevertheless, lohodu lo chachamim, the chachamim did not agree with this position. So then, if that's the case, our mission that says, vayuvi chachamim, if he's mitkavein, ini duwe du, techidami, echimishkachala. Where's the case that he can testify? According to the differentiation that the Amoraim brought until now, you say, if he's being matir, no good. If he's coming to be a dud, fine. And that'll be what the Mishnah meant, that if he's just coming, not being mitkavein, yes, being mitkavein. But now, if you're telling me that even if he intends to testify, that it's no good, then where's the case where we do believe him? When he's not testifying, what's that case? When he's just talking, he's having a conversation, you overhear the conversation between two individuals, that's enough to give us, or we can take that information and bank on it and use that information. If he's coming specifically to testify, then we won't accept it. This guy's walking around and saying, is there a guy named Chivai here, or is there a household called Chivai here? And he says, listen, I'm coming to give you the news that Chivai passed away, and I'm looking for the household of Chivai. Household of Chivai, I want to tell them that Chivai passed away. And Rabbi Yosef married off his wife, allowed his wife to get married, because he wasn't coming to testify, he was coming to inform the family about the fact that he knew that their husband had passed away, or their father had passed away. This guy was walking along and saying, Vaile le parsha zriza, dava bumpumpatita dushochiv. Woe is to, here, parashim is probably cavalrymen. Zriza means very strong. This very mighty, powerful cavalryman, who's obviously Jewish, dava bumpumpatita, that was from Pumpatita, dushochiv, that he died. So this guy is looking for them, announcing or making this announcement that he passed away, and he's giving over the information. Again, he's not testifying, he's just telling them the information. And again, Rav Yosef, now married off, or others say that it was Ravala Debetu, his wife. They allowed her to get married based on this testimony. That he's looking, who is this? Who's the household of Chasa? Where's the household of Chasa? Tova Chasa. Because Chasa drowned. We were out on the ship, and Chasa drowned, and he's coming to tell the family about the information. I'm Rav Nachman, Helukim! He takes a shvua. Achluk vare lechasa! The fish ate up Chasa! So now, midiburei de Rav Nachman, azal debitu de chasa, the wife of chasa overheard Rav Nachman taking the shavua that the fish ate up her husband. So she went ahead and got married. Vinsava. Vau amrulav lo mide. They didn't stop her. After she had gotten married, nobody came and said, oh, you gotta get divorced. You shouldn't have done this. Amravashu shmamina. So now what do you learn? Ha, damur rabbanan maim shen lem sof ishto asura. This is what I said to you earlier in the Gemara. It's going to come back at the end of the Gemara. When we say that the maim shen lem sof, that the woman is asura, hanimile lechatchila, that's when she comes and counsels with Beit Din and wants to know what the halacha is, there we tell her she can't get married because of this issue. Aval inasim, if she's already married, lo mafkin lamina. We do not force her to get divorced in that case. We do not ask her to get divorced because in all likelihood he died. We're worried about a very, very small percentage or small miut over here. Generally, in any other situation, we would dictate by rov. We would say, ala rov, a person like this is dead. Here we don't want to do this because there's too much at risk. By erva, there's so much at risk over here that we don't want to take a risk and we want 100% certainty, not just 90% or 80% certainty. So we aren't passing like the rov. With regards to other things here, we would pass like the rov and say, maim shen lem sof. In all likelihood, this person does not emerge and will not emerge and he's probably dead. But again, for erva, we want certainty. So again, the chatchila, we're going to tell you she's got to wait until we get better information. Bidiavad, if she got married, we're going to let her stay married because ala rov, the person is probably dead in this situation. Igad Amri, ansaba Rav Nachman the Bitu. Some say no, that Rav Nachman actually married her off with chatchila. Amar chasa gavar rabba ita. That Chaso is a big guy. He's a big gun. He's a famous individual. If he actually emerged somewhere else, people would know him, recognize him, and then we would get word that he was alive. Velohi, it doesn't make a difference. Veloshna gavar rabba. Veloshna lav gavar rabba. Doesn't matter if he's a big gun or not a big gun. Diavad in lechatchila lo. Lechatchila, we do not marry off the wife. Bidiavad, we do allow the wife to stay married if she did not counsel with us and got married anyway. We let her stay married again because we go by the rov. Now over here, there are a number of things to discuss. First of all, Rav Avad Yosef, who in general does not have a necessarily favorable view towards non-religious Jews in terms of their status. Over here, by Edut Yisham, by Agunot, he accepts them as Edim. Not just in Mesiach Lefi Tumo, he's willing to accept them like Edim and says that they are believed. They have a Nemanut by the cases of Agunot. That's a huge chiddush that Rav Yosef says you can rely on non-religious individuals and they have full nemanut in these situations. That's number one. Number two is, Rav Yosef mentioned this and other poskim mentioned this, that when we are matir and aguna, that we wait 12 months. That even after a matir and aguna, we wait 12 months just to be sure. Even though the evidence is there, we wait 12 months just to ensure that he does not emerge or come out. I mean, that because in all these cases, there is this little chance or small probability that he survived. In order to make sure that's not the case, we wait 12 months. We assume within the 12-month period, if he was alive, he would have come back home. We would have known about the fact that he's alive. After 12 months, we can assume that that's not the case. So that's an additional factor that is considered in many of these cases, is that we wait the 12-month period. Again, here, in the cases of famous people, you see the Gemara rejects that differentiation. Seemingly logical differentiation, they reject it. Again, maybe people are, a lot of times in these cases, can be disoriented or when they survive these things, they may not have memory or traumatized in a way that they don't remember how to get home or so on and so forth. And therefore, it's not as obvious. But again, today in the modern world and with certain contained situations, if the person doesn't show up after 12 months, that's helpful evidence to us if we're going to pass them for other reasons that these individuals have passed away. So now when it comes to the World Trade Center, there were a number of issues with the World Trade Center, and that's from both sides. There were husbands who had wives in the World Trade Center. And there are also wives who had husbands in the World Trade Center. So in the cases that dealt with husbands that had wives in the World Trade Center, over there we do go after the rov, and we will rely on the rov, because there the Easter for the husband to get married again is only an Easter de Rabbanan. It's under the cherem of the Rabbeinu Gershom. So there we can be much more makil. And there, if there's substantial, circumstantial evidence that people did not survive that disaster, then we will allow the husband to get married based on that, because again, there's only an Easter the Rabbanan involved. Whereas, the other way around, where a woman had a husband there, then we have an Isor Deoraita that we're dealing with, and there we have to go through the normal course of Agunot and dealing with the testimony. So, when it came to this issue, there were a number of articles written about it. I'll just give you a summary about some of the conclusions or some of the issues that were raised. First of all, there were three different categories, and again, they had to consult experts. They used a Beit Din that involved people that were very careful, well-known Talmidei Chachamim, also people who are Daiko Mitzvah, people who look into the matter very much so. They had one person do a lot of the research, and then that person presented the research to the other parties, and they also consulted with Rav Avadya Yosef, they consulted with
Rav Zalman Nechemiah Goldberg.
When they came to give the final psak, again, what I explained before, that we try to get as much counsel, as much approval from the Gedolim, in order that this should be seen as a psak halacha that carries weight, and that has no questions about it. So there they divided up the individuals who died in the World Trade Center depending on a number of factors. One factor is their location within the World Trade Center, which is, first of all, if we knew, or we had information that they were in a certain place in the World Trade Center. And that has to do with the nature of where the planes hit the World Trade Center. So for instance, the plane that hit the first World Trade Center, anybody above a certain floor, I think it was floor 92 on that case, that was above that floor did not survive. The plane at that point, and they consulted with experts, there's not a single survivor that was ever found from above those floors because all egress was cut off. The elevator shafts and both stairwells were destroyed by the plane. And that means that anybody who was floor 92 and above did not survive, and we can make that assumption with regards to anybody who was known to be up there, that was sighted up there, or because of their regular routine, most likely was up above the 92nd floor, they definitely died in the crash because there's no way. There are no survivors from that floor. In the second building, that's also interesting because there the plane hit on a lower floor, but there it destroyed the elevator shaft and stairwell B, but stairwell A, for a short, very short period of time, was still able to be accessed. There were 10 people who survived from that point and upwards, from the 78th floor and above, but they were all near the stairwell when the plane hit. Since they were near the stairwell, they were able to get into it quickly and escape. But anybody after that, the stairwell was destroyed or ruined after that point in time, and nobody survived. Those 10 people who survived had to be hospitalized and with serious or near fatal injuries. And if they were not hospitalized immediately, they would have died. So therefore, if the person wasn't near the stairwell plus hospitalized immediately, there's no way they could have survived. So again, in that building, you could also assume above that level that if someone was above that level, then they definitely did not survive. So that's the first stage. We're making a determination that anybody from a certain point and above did not survive, but the individual was found there, then you can assume that they are dead. The next thing is people where we found fragments or parts of the body. So again, here, if the body's found within 3 days, that's the psak halacha that we've seen here, then they're identifiable as long as the face is intact and they can be identified, then for sure, of course, we would identify them and allow their wives to get married. Most of the situations the World Trade Center did not involve that because of the pressure and the compaction that happened with the falling of the building, that most people did not survive intact. And they had bone fragments or pieces of bodies, but they never found really whole bodies, I don't think, or major parts that they could identify. Now over here, that comes back to what we spoke about before, about what's called simanim muvhakim. So if they could identify through simanim muvhakim, and that might be dental records, that might be DNA, those are ways that they could identify if they find remains of the individual. So in that case, we can identify, and based on that, we could suggest that the person did not survive. Again, even if they find a part of the body, but it's not an essential part of the body, you could argue that they survived, but given the circumstantial evidence surrounding it and the finding of those parts of the body, the likelihood of survival was so low that we would be matir in that case. In addition to that, if we don't have that, then we start to look for other simanim. And now they have to again be simanim that we can rely on. It's not something that everybody has. Again, you have to have a limited. If you find features about the individual, something that the individual was unique to them, it must be unique. If it's something that's shared by other people, they're short, they're tall, those types of things don't determine. So again, if we can find some sort of simanim like that, or possessions that are simanim that are always with them or attached to their body, a wallet that they always carried, certain things that are always together with them, in those situations, we can use that as secondary evidence in order to free the agunot or allow the wife to get married. So again, the process by which they went through this was to, first of all, investigate what the facts were. After they had the facts down, then they had to categorize the individuals into these different categories. In all these cases, they also, based on Rav Avadya Yosef, waited 12 months. Even after they were matched with the Agunot, they asked them to wait 12 months and said that the heter goes into effect after 12 months just to be certain. It's just a mesorah that they'll have, and you should wait 12 months just to be certain because the elapsing of time, I think, for a number of reasons. One, if the person's going to show up, they should show up during that period of time. In addition, and it was true in the World Trade Center as well, a lot of evidence was collected in that period of time. And therefore, it helps to bolster the cases in some of these cases because the evidence then is there, or they find DNA, or they find parts of the bodies, all of those things held out over that 12-month period. Right, that's just a short summary. There are many tshuvot written about it. It's an extensive, extensive issue because it comes up, unfortunately, so many times in Jewish history, and therefore there's a tremendous amount of literature written about it. Rav Avad Yosef is very famous for dealing with it during the Yom Kippur War. He was matir many, many agunot. That's part of where he became very famous. That many of the other poskim backed away and didn't want to deal with it. And he, with his tremendous erudition and understanding of halacha, came in and was matir. And there he gained a certain amount of familiarity with the people and became famous because of his ability to be matir. Rav Herzog did it during the war for Atzmaut in 1948, the War of Independence. He did it then. Rav Moshe Feinstein and other poskim were very involved from after World War II in being matir agunot. The previous century, there were so many wars that it unfortunately came up a lot and the poskim had to deal with it. So we have a lot of modern day literature and tshuvot about it because of that. But again, we have it from the Otzer tshuvot. We have a tremendous amount of literature that speaks about it over the ages in these cases where people, because of whether they were traveling overseas, boating accidents, incarceration, enemies, all sorts of things that cause these types of issues, and when they can be matir agunot, there is a tremendous amount of tshuvot written about it, and the rabbanon make unbelievable efforts in order to ensure that these women do not get left as agunot as much as they can based on the evidence that they have that's at hand. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the bottom of Kuf Chaf Aleph Amud Bet.